Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Now, I'm on a break over the Christmas period, so I thought I would re-release a few episodes that really connected with listeners from 2023. And in September, I spoke to dog lover and activist Niall Harbison.
I feel so blessed that like it happened. I know this, that's like horrifically hard for my mum and dad or friends to have gone through it. And for me, obviously, but I feel like it's the best thing that's ever happened, because once you strip everything away, and I sort of had a, it's like I got up to the gates of death or whatever you want to call it, and I was like, saw what the meaning of life was, and I was like, okay, like your new car, your new iPhone, your new whatever, your designer shoes or whatever, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter one bit. You're in a hospital bed here, and they're not the important things. The things I was thinking about was like playing football when I was 8 years old, you know, running around the fields. I was thinking about being in Australia, backpacking, like sailing on a boat. I was, you know, it was memories that I had. I wasn't sitting there thinking about, Jesus, yeah, that time I got the iPhone 8, or that time I made a nice sale on an advertising campaign, you know, like yeah. None of that was in my head.
If you're an animal lover and you're on social media, there's a strong possibility that you already follow Niall. Originally from County Tyrone, he actually grew up in Brussels, but he never lost his Irish accent. And over the past 21 months, he's been devoting his time to help save street dogs in Thailand. And to fully understand the man he is today, we need to go back through some of the experiences that have shaped him in his life. When he was 13, his parents separated, and his mother then went on to have a relationship with an abusive partner, which had a massive impact on him. He's been a private chef of billionaires. He's also been a successful and at times controversial entrepreneur. And at his lowest point, he found himself in ICU after a drink and drug-fueled binge. He's sober for about 3 years now, and his mission is to halve the population of stray dogs in the world over the next 20 to 30 years. His book, Hope, How Street Dogs Have Taught Me the Meaning of Life, was released this autumn, and it is an amazing read. I really hope you feel inspired by our conversation, as Niall is the perfect example of how it's never too late to change your life. So a few weeks ago, I was on holidays in Donegal with my family, and you sent me a message on Instagram, and it was one of those moments where I was so flattered and I was so thrilled that you sent me a message, because I have been a follower of yours, as are thousands and thousands of people all over the world who follow the brilliant work that you do. And when you said that you were interested in coming on the podcast, that was just a great moment for me. So I'm very grateful.
Well,
thanks.
It's more down to the people who listen to your podcast, because I just asked, because I've kind of lost touch with Irish media a little bit being away. And I was like, you know, who's doing the best podcast at the moment? And I swear to God, about 50 people said your name. So that's why I just sent you a little message. And so you have people out there spreading the word about you.
That's so cool. That's so cool. Right. Let's talk about the book. And I suppose the natural thing is to kind of go right back
to when you were a young lad. So, you know, when people listen to your accent, it's still, it's very strong, despite the fact that you told me in a voice note on WhatsApp that you were only a few months old when you moved to Brussels.
Yeah, I think the accent probably gets stronger maybe talking to my parents or even talking to you or anybody back home. But no, I do. I've kept it. I grew up in Brussels, but was born in the north in Tyrone. And yeah, I've kept the, I mean, all my friends were Irish growing up abroad. But yeah, the accent is still there, but it gets stronger, I think, as the closer I get to home.
You had a lovely childhood, very happy childhood. And like a lot of people, the teenage years can be a bit bumpy. Can be a bit tricky.
Yeah, I mean, my parents just split up, which I think it just sort of hit me quite hard, I think. And my mom left, and it sort of out of nowhere, it just sort of came out, you know, from one day to the next. I didn't see it coming. I think maybe a bit oblivious when you're that age, you think everything's idyllic in your own head, and you know, maybe it's not between your parents. And so yeah, they split up, and then my mom moved in with somebody else who was abusive, and I kind of lived through that, seeing her getting beaten up, for want of a better word. And yeah, I always would have had a lot of guilt and issues from that moment onwards. I mean, I think it was about 13 or so. So it's probably quite a, you're probably at the age where you're just about to start maybe going out and drinking, and maybe not 13, but 14, 15, you know, you're starting to just figure out who you are. So that kind of rocked my world a little bit and threw me off course a bit. And I'd just gone through this sort of divorce, and I just had a lot of guilt for it, because like, I mean, I still would, and I'd be like, why didn't I do something? Or, you know, I was probably hiding in my room. I was hiding in my room. But I was like, why didn't I not just pick up a tennis racket and go and defend her, or, you know, do something? But that's easy to say now. But so I would have taken it out by going out drinking, or, you know, finding other ways to deal with it. I always had guilt that I didn't stand up for.
Is that something that stayed with you now, do you think, at this stage in your life?
No, yes, to a certain extent. But now that I've stopped drinking, I think I've processed it. And some people will always be like, oh, geez, that's 25 years ago, or, you know, maybe more, so nearly 30 years ago. Like, why, just, you know, like, move on. But seeing your mom getting punched in the face is, I don't know, it's a pretty hard thing to get out of your head.
Can't imagine, Al, yeah. Mm-hmm. And as I say, a childhood lasts a lifetime. So even if it is a long time ago, the experiences that we go through, they stay with us.
Yeah, big time. I think that, like, I do the dogs now, and I know we'll get on to that in a minute, but I see such innocence in them. And same with children, you know, like, they're such innocence, and they just love playing and, you know, being themselves, and, you know, they forget about time, and, you know, they're just a pure emotion of happiness. But as we get into, like, teenage years, all of us just seem to, maybe not all of us, but we just have so much baggage and so much serious stuff and so much the weight of the world on our shoulders to deal with. We lose that sort of, that sense of fun, and life gets serious very quickly, not just for me, but for everybody, I think.
So that initial phase, I suppose, when your mother left, you were with your dad.
Yeah, stayed with him, and she went on and lived with this other guy for about 3 or 4 years, I think. Got to 3 or 4 years, a bit longer actually, but I was there just at weekends, but I, like, dreaded seeing him. I mean, there was patches where it was okay, and he'd sort of you know, like all abusive people would be nice and apologize and all that sort of stuff, but it was just not a very happy time to be growing up, really.
I would imagine then there was a stage where you just wanted to get out.
Yeah, definitely. And I started playing up at school big time. I mean, I don't think I was ever incredibly academic or anything like that, but I would have I got kicked out of 2 different schools. I didn't actually have any qualifications. I failed the same year 3 times in a row. I think I have ADHD, but like, they weren't really diagnosing that sort of stuff back then. It wasn't really on the radar, but I just was terrible in school. And so, like, my whole world was just very turbulent in those years and very upside down. And I just didn't know anything. So I turned to, like, drink and cigarettes and joints and all those sort of things, which everybody would have kind of been dabbling in anyway, but I probably already was hitting them a little bit hard.
And then chefing became an area that you went into. And what's really interesting about you, Niall, is you know, despite you saying that, you know, you struggled academically at school, which is something that a lot of listeners, including myself, will resonate with, you've also, whatever you turn your hand to, you make it work. I know the majority of this conversation is going to be about your incredible work with the dogs of Thailand, but like what you did in your pre-dog life is really impressive. And I say that very genuinely. You seem to just excel in everything that you've done. So with chefing, it wasn't a case that you were working down the local restaurant and tipping away and that was grand. You went to very high levels in your career.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I'm always very obsessive about things. So like in chefing, I was really lucky because I didn't have anything to do after school. And my dad was, I think at his wit's end, trying to figure out what to do with me, like set me on a course. And he obviously saw me in the kitchen doing something. I must have just shown an interest. And he was like, look, why would you not go and try and be a chef? Like, I can get you into a course. And I went to Cahill Brewer Street, catering college. And I loved it. I was like, God, this is everything that I like. Not the college. College was like terrible. I was like, you had 4 hours to make, you know, a bowl of soup and 2 sandwiches. So I was like really quickly bored. But I went to work for Conrad Gallagher, who was, you know, slightly older listeners might remember. It was kind of the place back in the day in Dublin. It was a mad restaurant and it was like Michelin star. And I walked in.
He was such a character.
Oh, he was mental. He was actually really good crack. There was a load of bad stuff at the end. Like, I mean, but to be around was just insane. Like, I just walked in the back door and I was like, look, can I get a job? And it was like, it was on South William Street at the end and at the time. And I remember walking in and there was like about 20 huge men. Cause like I said, I was just a little 17-year-old boy and they were all like running around with knives and like screaming at each other and like just madness, like absolute madness, like kind of Gordon Ramsay, if you could imagine 20 of them, and they were French and they were just like angry. And I was like, this is brilliant. And I just like, I can't remember what I was paid at the time, probably like 50 quid a week or something, like minimal, like just peanuts. But I was down the back, like just picking spinach and peeling potatoes and getting screamed at. And like, you just had to keep your head down and like hope that nobody would like give you a dig in the ribs or, you know, like it was a different world back then. There was, it was super exciting and I loved it and thrived in it. And I think I worked my way up in that because I was kind of cheeky, or I kind of bypassed the all the formal training and all that and just, loved it.
And you were good.
Loved the
and
work. You were good. I don't know if I was even that good. I was kind of just cheeky more than I got on. Like, really? I was able, like, everybody was terrified of Conrad and they'd literally like go and hide and I'd just be sort of having a laugh at them and slagging him. So like he looked after me and, but no, yeah, a little bit. I was very determined. Once I got into it, I was very obsessive about things and I wanted to be as good as possible, but I was by no means the most talented chef, but I got by.
And then you went working on yachts. And again, it wasn't a case of, you know, like it's kind of a who's who. It's all the names of people that you have, you know, cooked for. So am I right in thinking like Tom Hanks, Bono, kind of goes on. I get the feeling from times when you've spoken that you're a bit like, I'm not really great talking about this stuff. I don't really love talking about that time. Would I be right?
I don't mind. No, I don't mind. I'm just not great at talking about myself. Yeah, I think like a lot of the times, like chefing, yeah, it does. It sounds amazing. But like, I was working
hard graft.
Like Peacock Al. Yeah, really hard graft, like unbelievably so. Like you're working 16 hours a day and then drinking in the evening and like it's not, you know, it's not cookbooks
glamorous.
And glamorous at all. Like you're getting screamed at and but then that's why I actually decided to go and work on the yachts. I first did a ski season in France. Somebody told me, they were like, oh look, there's this job, you can go and work in a hotel in France. And I was like, that sounds great. So I went over there and was just cooking really simple food and skiing all the snowboarding all day. And then somebody else was like, oh, there's these yachts down in the south of France that you can work on as a chef. And I was like, right, sign me up. So I went down there and just kind of landed on my feet again and started working for like billionaires as a private chef, which it's more like, it's so easy. Like you're only cooking for two people, or maybe if they have guests, a few people. But like the pressure was gone off, the Michelin star restaurants was gone, and it was nice traveling the world cooking for billionaires. So that was enjoyable, I'm not going to lie.
So while you're away and you're doing this kind of work, Do you mind me asking, like, what's the environment like at home for your mother? Is she still in that relationship? What's going on?
No, she'd actually moved on from that. So my sister had been born with that guy, she'd moved on, and like we're super close now, and like it took a while to work it all out, obviously, you know, it wasn't overnight. Yeah. But he eventually moved on, which was, you know, what we were all saying to do, and she met somebody else really nice, and my dad remarried. And but I think it had just sort of damaged me certainly from a relationship standpoint, because my mum left my dad sort of, you know, in the middle of the night, or, you know, it's from one day to the next, nobody saw it coming, and when I was 13, so my relationships with women would always have been like a great relationship. I'm still friends with like all my ex-girlfriends, but just trust issues from like my mom leaving. So I'd never, very bad at settling down and keeping a steady relationship going.
It makes complete sense. Is there an element of, with the dogs, that there's a sense of, because dogs by their nature are loyal and steadfast, that, you know, they're not going to go, they're not going to leave?
The dogs are super friendly, super loyal, super, and that is one of the, I mean, there's 100 reasons why I like them, but they're so loyal and I do like that. Yeah, that's, I think you hit the nail on the head with that one.
Yeah, right. So you're you know, you're cooking for billionaires and that's tipping along, but all the while bubbling in the back is this reliance, I suppose, on booze, on drugs, and that's just becoming more of an issue.
Yeah, I mean, you get away with it, especially in Ireland, as you know, in your, you know, teens, early 20s, in the hospitality industry, like nobody bats an eyelid. Like I was drinking, you know, double vodkas and Lucozades and like just mad stuff and shots and all that. And, you know, when you're 20, 23, what those sort of ages, like it's just the done thing, or it was, certainly was then. We used to go for a few pints in the afternoon on our split shifts, you know, from during the working day. And, but I was, you know, like, well, some people were obviously drinking maybe Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I was already drinking, you know, adding a Wednesday and a Sunday night in there, or, you know, so, or drinking on my own. And, I was also having like panic attacks and depression at that stage, but I didn't even know what they were. Like, I had no idea, because again, it's like, what's that, 25 years ago? Like, not talked about at all, especially
right,
for men,
yeah.
for men. And like, there's a lot of great stuff now on mental health, but back then I was just getting these like anxiety attacks, and I was like,
what,
I thought I was
this?
Having a heart attack. Yeah, I thought, like, I was like, Jesus, I must have smoked too many cigarettes or something. I was like, I just had no idea what it was. So all that was, but then I could, when you've got depression and stuff like that, you can kind of self-medicate. So if you start feeling a bit anxious, like I would have been, I'd have a few pints and then it would be gone. And that I was already self-medicating at that stage without really knowing what was going on.
And you're so right, because like we're the same age, and I'm thinking back to it myself. Like for years during the summer holidays, I was a waitress, and you know, restaurant life, I know I wasn't at your level, but like it's busy. It is full on, and it's go, go, go until, you know, you clean up the tables and everybody's out, and then you go for a few jars or whatever it is. But there is that culture, you know, within that environment as well. And I know certainly, and I won't name names, but there were certainly a few chefs that needed a few jars as the night was going on, just to keep them tipping along, you know. And that was 100%. That was kind of the culture. Yeah,
100%. I've seen chefs doing lines of coke, or no, it was more like pills back then, I think. Or like, yeah, having a, like maybe starting to have their pints at about 9 o'clock, you know, as the evening's wearing on. And then like, yeah, if you're a waitress or even a chef or juniors or whatever, like you've had a stressful, busy, long day, and then somebody puts a nice glass of wine or a pint in front of you at 10 o'clock and your friends are there with you and you're stressed, of course you're going to drink it. And then before you know it, it's 2 a.m. and you're in Reynard's or wherever, whatever late bar it is, because you know you've started so late drinking, you're only drinking at 11 o'clock. So it's a really, really tough lifestyle. I often wonder, is it changed now, and is there more like, not health and safety, but like, you know, mental welfare and stuff like that? But I'd say, you know, in the restaurant industry, it's probably quite similar. It's a high pressure environment.
When you were on the yachts, you decided to have a bit of a career change, so can we talk about that and where you went next?
Yeah, so I loved the yachts, and there was a lot of traveling, and I had a lot of spare time, actually, because the guests are not on that much and the internet was just starting. So I was kind of like, so much time on the internet, I was kind of teaching myself about Twitter had just started and Facebook and YouTube had just come on. And I was like, these things are like really incredible. I got the sense at the time. And I just started teaching myself how to do those. And then I was like fed up with the chefing, to be honest. I was like, I wanted just a change. So I got into like online marketing and starting my own businesses and complete 180. I just looked at the chefing game and I was like, you know, if I was, you know, 50, would I want to be doing this and have kids or anything like that? And I was like, no, this is no life for anybody at that age. So I was like, career change, definitely.
Mm. And then obviously, again, like all things you seem to do, you didn't do anything by half. So you just threw yourself into these ideas that you had and then they became these roaring successes. So Love in Dublin is obviously the big one.
Yeah, and they're always, it's like anybody who does anything that's seen as a success, you know, like when you look at it in hindsight, it is, but there were so many ups and downs in those years and drunken binges and, you know, it's not easy starting businesses and, you know, finding capital and failing businesses and, you know, so if you look at the sort of trajectory now, it looks nice and clean and it was a success, but definitely very, very hard. But I enjoyed those times. And it was, I think I'm just always good at being in the right place at the right time. That's my skill. If I have one skill, it's just, I kind of seem to land on my feet. And like when I came into that world, I just had taught myself about social media and everything. And most people didn't know about that yet. Like it's so obvious now, but back then it was like, you're on like Facebook, like what, like why would we be on that as a business, you know? But so I was just really, really lucky, I think, in my timing.
Yeah, you're very modest, which is a really lovely quality of yours. And I can tell that you're like, yeah, at times kind of uncomfortable with praise or let's delve into this and well done, Niall. You're like, yeah, okay, yeah, let's just move on from this kind of thing. But anyway, Love in Dublin, you decided, okay, I've had enough of this, so I'm now going to sell it and move on to another chapter.
Yeah, I was in Manchester at that time. I did sort of Love in Dublin, and then I'd moved over to do Love in Manchester. And I can remember the moment clearly, like business was going okay. It always looks better on the outside than the inside. But it was like, you know, we're short on cash and, you know, like we're really always struggling to grow and all that sort of stuff. And I was suffering a little bit with depression at that time. Well, not a little bit, a lot with depression at the time. And I remember clearly I was walking Snoop, my dog, and it was just those sort of, you know, Dublin or Manchester days where it's dark at 4 o'clock, it's freezing, like it was barely bright in the day to start with. And then I just put my foot it looked like a piece of ground, but it turned out to be like an icy puddle. And I my whole leg was covered in cold water. And I was just like, I don't know if I can swear on this, but I was just like, fuck this. I was like, okay, yeah. Well, then I was like, fuck this shite. I was like, I am done with this. I just had a moment where it was literally in that instant. I was like, I am leaving this part of the world and going somewhere hot and somewhere where I can work on my health, because I'm not enjoying this. And it was within that second that I decided that. It obviously took probably 4 or 5 months to make it happen, but that it was as clear as that.
And that's where you've kind of been in life. I would imagine you're quite instinctual when something feels, you know, that like that in that moment, there was no getting away from, I am not happy, so I'm going to do something that changes what's making me unhappy.
Maybe to my detriment. I suppose people like certainty, and or if you're in a relationship or family, or, you know, people think things through. And whereas I'm just like, yeah, I probably jump in the spur of the moment, but I'm just like, look, I could maybe make some more money by staying here or whatever. But like, if I'm this bloody miserable and, you know, I can't get out of bed in the afternoon because I'm so depressed, I've got to change it. So yeah, I'd always, apart from now, I don't want to change a thing now because everything, I'm really happy with everything at the moment.
Yeah.
But I was just, I know this from talking to everybody. Everybody kind of goes through phases where they're like, Jesus, what am I doing in this life? Like, what? What's even the point? What's even the point of going into work or going to, And even nice things like your, you know, your kids or your, you've saved up for a car or whatever it's, you know, like you're doing all these things and then you're just like, Jesus, is this, there's got to be something more than this to life. You know, like I think everybody has that deep inside them. So, yeah, I just sort of acted on it, I guess.
And maybe you're somebody who just needs sunshine also. I mean, do you think you you know, is it seasonal affective disorder, do you feel? Is there an element of that?
It is definitely. And then I also worked in media in Dublin, which was like, you might notice like it's sort of like November onwards, it's like party season, like Christmas starts in about the, like work stops in about the middle of November and everybody is drinking for about 6 weeks and there's nothing done. And like I used to slip into that and there was no excuse, no getting away from it. The nights were short, the days were short, dark, everybody drinking, and I would just go into a spiral. So I used to just clear off for the month of December and go on to Thailand because it was sunny and healthy and nice cheap food. And so that was my escape. That's how I kind of started thinking about Thailand and then made the transition to it full time.
So initially when you moved to Thailand, or you were holidaying there, was it for the, you know, the healthy living or was it like for the party element?
No, definitely for the healthy limit. Okay. 100%. But I slipped into it. I was there and doing quite well, you know, 6 months sober or 3 months or, you know, a few different patches like that. But then what happened was I was going out with a girl, Sarah, who I'm still good friends with, and we had a good relationship. And then that sort of broke down and COVID hit, which I think hit every couple and every individual like massively, you know, we're locked in the house. And so she left and a few things sort of. And then I'd nobody checking up on me, like not that I need it, but like I'd nobody to say no, you know, you could drink every day. And there, you know, like I could start drinking at 10 in the morning. There'd be, you know, I might have a bit of shame if I was in Dublin doing that. I'd be like, Jesus, if I'm in this pub and somebody walks in and sees me drinking here at 9:30, like that's not a good look. Whereas in Thailand, I'd just be like, ah, everybody's on holiday. Like, sure, I'll just have the pint anyway.
I mean, in the beginning stages of COVID, I think it was a coping mechanism for a lot of people was to kind of, I mean, I think a lot of people felt like, okay, it's almost like Christmas holidays. It's a bit like that. Yes. We don't know what day of the week it is. Sure, look at, why wouldn't we have a pint or a glass or a vodka or a gin or whatever? Because, you know, we don't know what's around the corner. And there was an element of that for a lot of people. So I don't think you were the only one, but perhaps you maybe stepped it up.
Yeah, it's when you're an alcoholic and a situation like that arises, it's like music to your ears. You're like, Jesus, everybody else is drinking at 2 p.m. And I'm like, it's now socially acceptable. So let's load the house up with whatever, you know? So yeah, but I wouldn't underestimate. I think we've brushed it under the carpet that whole period of time, but like we were all like our heads were going clean mad really being locked up, so that didn't help. But it certainly wasn't the main reason, but it was just another factor that I just went on an almighty binge then and ended up in hospital. So that was kind of the start of it.
And you ended up in ICU, so it was like it was proper serious.
Oh yeah, it was horrific. Like at the end of the binge, like I'd always had binges and really bad binges and come downs and stuff like that. But this was like, I got to the stage where I was drinking, I'm not joking, about 4 bottles of wine a day, 10 pints and a bottle of whiskey, and then having loads of Valium to just sort of knock the edge off things. And like, you're probably wondering, like, that sounds exaggerated. Like, how could you drink that much? But like, I'd wake up at maybe 4 a.m. just in the horrors, and I'd have like a bottle of wine just to calm down. That would get me, you know, to maybe 7 in the morning. Then I'd start like having some beers. Then like I'd be drunk already by 11 a.m. So I'd go back to sleep for a few hours, then wake up another couple of bottles of wine. And I'd be getting drunk sort of 4 times a day and just having little naps in between. So it was, and then I'd maybe like try and calm it down. So I'd have 2 Valiums just to sleep. So it was horrific. So I went on and on for 6 weeks. And then I think it was more a mental breakdown than like, there was obviously the physical side of stuff. But I remember about 3 weeks before I ended up in hospital, I just started crying. Like I'd cry like anybody, like if there was a dog or, you know, something sad, I'd have the odd cry, but not much, not spectacularly. But I was sitting like, or walking down the road or sitting in a pub, and like the tears would just start coming out of my eyes without anything sad happening. Or I'd be like in a restaurant and I'd just suddenly like be talking to somebody and then I'd feel like the tears streaming down my eyes without anything sad happening. So that was going on for a few weeks. So I think there was obviously something inside my body that was just like breaking down basically completely. Yeah. So, and then I ended up in ICU, which was horrific. Yeah. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I mean, it was like, I had to get a friend to come and get me. I obviously couldn't drive. I could barely walk. I think I could walk, but it was sort of like, and I wasn't drunk at this stage. I was drunk, but I wasn't like hammered. But like somebody had to, like, they had to carry me, sort of, you know, like two people carry me into the hospital. And then they just immediately started going to work on, like, yeah, drips, heart monitors, I just remember big needles coming in. I was so out of it, I didn't really know what was going on. Like big needles injected into my leg with some sort of, like, I don't know, like a calmant or whatever, you know, like something, because it's very, very dangerous to stop alcohol cold like that. So the first sort of 48 hours were horrific. I don't know if anybody who's listening might suffer from anxiety. So this was like anxiety, the worst anxiety you've ever had, times 100. It was like, you know, like a fly might land on the wall and I'd be like, Jesus, the fly's here to kill me. And, or, you know, there was a noise outside and I'd be like, Jesus, that's, the police are here because they know I'm on Valium. Or, the, you know, it was just basically the horrors. You know, the way you'd, like, you'd have a light hangover on a Monday or whatever and you'd be a little bit nervous going into work, or just the fear, but times 100. So it was, yeah, it was horrible. And like my hands were like claws. I was just like, my whole body was just like rigid. It was yeah, really horrible.
God, it sounds awful. It sounds like, from what you're saying, like, it's surprising that you even got that far in a way, because of the amount that you were pouring into your body.
Well, I think I was trying to kill myself more or less, but I'd never be brave enough to do it. But I was like, if I was just drinking like hard whiskey and I was like, look, if I drink enough here, it'll numb it and it'll go away. And then maybe with a bit of luck, I won't wake up and have to face this tomorrow. That's the way I was thinking. But then the thing with alcohol is, as you probably know, if you're hungover, like if you drink enough, the hangover will eventually go, you know, like the cure or whatever you want to call it. Like, you know, if you've had a huge wedding and you have, you know, five glasses of wine, you're going to come around, you're going to start feeling okay. So I always knew that. But this was the first time in my life I ever got to the stage where like three bottles of wine and a bottle of whiskey and I'd still be in the horrors. I couldn't drink through it. And then I'd have to take two Valiums and then I'd have to, like, I was just a mess. Yeah.
So when you say that, was that a conscious thing do you think at the time, or was that something that you realized kind of when you look back on the experience that you didn't want to be here anymore, or was it something you were aware of at the time?
No, I was aware of it. I was aware of it, definitely. But I mean, that's the clearest example of being suicidal, of, you know, it really is like not wanting to wake up and trying to drink yourself to death. But I also was like a bit gutless and spineless that I wasn't able to do it, sort of thing, you know, like I basically it was like a cry for help, like, you know, I think you can look at it now, like, a definitely from living my life now, obviously didn't want to die, but I was just at that stage in my life, I was just horrendously miserable. So I just wanted to I have depression, I still have it, but not even a hundredth of what it was. But when you have depression, it's horrendous. Like it's like a fog and it doesn't lift. And then you put booze on top of it, it makes it just way worse. So I would anything to escape that horrific feeling.
So much of the chat so far has been, you know, on the heavy side, which when anyone follows you, that's maybe not what they're saying, because your account is pure joy and inspiration and love, and it brings so much goodness into the world, you know, what you're doing. And even following you over the past few days, again, you know, ahead of our chat, I've been following your your journey leaving Thailand, going to London, organizing the walks. I know you're absolutely exhausted from jet lag and a crazy schedule, and you're here talking to me, and I'm so grateful. But like, a lot of the chat right now is really intense, and it must feel like such a long time ago, even though relatively speaking, it's not that long ago that you were lying in that hospital bed, and look how you've turned your life around. But I suppose let's come to that moment now where you went, right, this is it, enough is enough. Or I don't know, is it a kind of a life flashing before your eyes moment that you go, something's got to give, something's got to change?
100%. Like, life flashing before the eyes, 100%. I was like, when I was rigged up to all the machines and stuff, I was like, okay, in 10 seconds, I'm going to die. Like, there's no doubt the way my body was feeling. And then I was like, in a minute's time, I'm definitely going to die. So when you're in that stage, you start thinking about what you've done and everything you've achieved. And I was like, okay, I've been a chef. I've been away from my family. I haven't had good relationships. I did, like, people are said you're successful. And I was like, what? Like, you've had like some little media company in Ireland where you've just like sold some advertising, or, you know, moved some numbers around spreadsheets. I was like, nobody is going to remember you beyond your immediate family. I was like, in 2 weeks time, you'll be, you know, be like that guy, lovely fella that was our friend, but he drank himself to death, and, you know, that was it. And I was like, that's no way to have lived your life. So I was like, I started slowly saying, like, if I can get through this next sort of, it was minute by minute at the time, I was like, if I can get to, you know, 5 to 9 or whatever time it was on the big clock on the hospital, I was like, then I'll see if I can think of a bit more of a plan. And I was like, if I get through this, everything changes. Everything changes. So I was talking to myself through it. And yeah, it was that. It was like, and I feel so blessed that, like, it happened. I know this, that's like horrifically hard for my mom and dad or friends to have gone through it. And for me, obviously. But I feel like it's the best thing that's ever happened. Because once you strip everything away, and I sort of had a, it's like I got up to the gates of death or whatever you want to call it, and I was like, saw what the meaning of life was. And I was like, okay, like your new car, your new iPhone, your new whatever, your designer shoes or whatever, it doesn't matter one bit. You're in a hospital bed here, and they're not the important things. The things I was thinking about was like playing football when I was 8 years old, you know, running around the fields. I was thinking about being in Australia backpacking, like sailing on a boat. I was, you know, it was memories that I had. I wasn't sitting there thinking about, Jesus, yeah, that time I got the iPhone 8, or that time I made a nice sale on an advertising campaign, you know, like, yeah. None of that was in my head.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's amazing stuff, Niall, because a lot of us have had moments in our lives where we do gain perspective, but perhaps not in as severe a situation as yours. And the majority of people won't, thankfully not, because that's a scary place to be. But I suppose, isn't it wonderful that a really traumatic experience that you went through and a really scary one becomes a blessing and becomes a gift in your life and one that you can draw on and do good with?
Do you know the way when you like, maybe you go and you get really fit, you get fit for 6 weeks or something, or you, and then you're like, Jesus, I'm never going back to that way again, where, you know, eating the chocolates and the burgers and or whatever. And then of course you do a couple of weeks later, or maybe you're, you know, you get sick and then you're lying in bed and you're like, Jesus, I need to start being healthier and eating vegetables or whatever, you know. Whereas this was just like an extreme version of that. It was like, Jesus, I will never drink in my life again, and I know it. So it was just, yeah, an extreme version of that feeling is what I've got.
How long are you sober now?
2 years and like 9 months. I don't even really count anymore, to be honest. It's, yeah, I'm very blessed.
That's a great place to be also, isn't it? That you're not kind of having to focus on it.
I just need to be careful, because I suppose there's other people. Like, depression is still very, you can never really get rid of it. And if I stop doing the things that make it, like if I start drinking again, I could end up in that place. So yeah, you just need to be very mindful.
Never take it for granted.
Like I always, no, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So you got better and you were able to leave the hospital. What happens next?
Yes. Oh, well, like a complete idiot. I got, like, it was 3 days in the hospital, I think, and I got out. And I swear to God, I got home. And like, obviously my body had been through like a once in a lifetime experience. And I got home to the little apartment I live in, and I went for a jog. Right. So like, this is the,
okay.
Like,
what not to do.
Like, yeah. I got 500 yards down the road and like, I nearly had to go back to the hospital again,
okay.
But I was just so keen to just like get healthy. That was the stupidest decision I've ever made. What actually happened was it took, I'm not joking you, about 6 months to get over it. Because like, yeah. I said, I think it was a mental breakdown, or for want of a better word. Like, I obviously got in, I had, like, I couldn't remember my email password, or, you know, like your banking, like passwords that you would just, you couldn't forget, you know, like that you've had your whole life. Or, and I was trying to, and I was like, I can't even remember these numbers. My brain was just mush. So it took me a long time to, there was months of sitting around like, watching like Netflix and going for walks, and but I was still very, very anxious. And like the first 2 to 3 months were still physically very tough, because I think there was just so much crap to come out of my body that I wasn't really able to do this, you know. My mind was quite good, but my body just wouldn't do anything that I wanted it to yet.
So were you doing this on your own, or were you getting help? As in, were you in rehab, or were you doing any therapy, or was it just, I have this, I'm gonna deal with this myself?
I probably shouldn't say this, because I think the proper way to go is rehab and get help and professional help. So I don't want to like put people off that, but I didn't do anything. I did it all on willpower, and that was really scary for like Sarah, who's my ex-girlfriend, who's trying to help me, and family and friends. They were trying to check me into places and, you know, all that sort of stuff, because they were like, look, he's just been in hospital, nearly died, he's obviously going to be back there in a couple of weeks. But I just knew in my own head, I couldn't explain it to anybody. I was like, I'd never felt like that. I was like, I'm done, that's it, I'm changing everything, and I'm never going back to that place. So like, it was a really tough time conveying that to other people, because they were so worried. But I was just like, yeah, I just did it all myself on willpower, which I genuinely don't want to like endorse that. I don't think that's the way to go.
But it's your truth, and it's incredible. Yeah. So like, absolute respect. After the 6 month period then, kind of building yourself back, and at this stage you're feeling good?
Yeah, feeling brilliant. Starting to do sports and stuff like that, and just rebuilding the body basically, and eating healthy. And I remember like I was making porridge one day after about 6 months, and I was like putting honey on top of it, and I like put a little bit too much, and I was like, Jesus, you're going a bit hard on the honey now, aren't you? And I caught myself, and I was like that was like 40 Marlboro Lights a couple of months ago. So like I went to the other extreme and got as healthy as I could.
So let's talk about the dogs. Let's talk about Lucky.
I'd always kind of fed dogs in Thailand a little bit because there's so many street dogs. Really hard for anybody who's not been in that part of the world to understand, but there's, you know, thousands. And I'd fed some here and there. But then I was kind of looking around because I'm obviously like, what, 41, 42 at that stage. And I'm like, all this new energy in life. And I'm like, I need to do something. I had no idea what to do. No idea. I had a blank canvas. I was thinking of all sorts of things, like anything. But then I just started feeding Lucky on the way home from football one night. It was a street dog. And I fed her. And then the next morning I woke up and I was like, because she was a little bit away, like 15 minutes away. I was like, Jesus, she needs food again today. So I went back and fed her again. And then that quickly sort of accumulated to about four dogs in her area. And I took her for a vet visit to just clear up some little issues she had. And then from there, it just snowballed. I just started going back to them every day. It was a nice little routine. And then it was eight dogs and then 20. And then suddenly before I knew it, I was feeding 80 dogs every single day, which was just off my moped. I'd just go and buy a big bag of food in the shops and go around feeding them. And I felt terrific. Felt like really just nice, you know, rewarding. It was a really nice feeling.
And like when you think about it, it's still a relatively short time that you've been doing the work that you're doing now, and the massive change and the difference that you're making, and in terms of the following that you've created is really remarkable, isn't it? I mean, is it about 2 years that you're doing this?
It's actually only 18 months. It's like January last year. Yeah.
Wow.
I just can't get my head around it. Like,
yeah,
I think I deleted all my social media profiles because I was just getting myself into trouble, getting like hammered, and then like going on Twitter and stuff. Like after four bottles of wine, you're not going to come out with like very wise stuff. So I deleted all my social media profiles, and then I started them again just for the dogs. And I really thought I'd, like a few thousand people might be interested, like friends and family. I had no idea what it would become or what it was. But yeah, it's 18 months now.
And from what I can see as well on your Instagram alone, like you're gaining like thousands of followers on almost a daily basis. It's growing all the time.
It's like mental. Like I can't, like, it's like an outer body experience or something. Like, I don't know. I just look at it and I'm like, I walked into like Hyde Park the other night and I just messaged and I was like, if anybody wants to come for a dog walk. And me and Megan, who helps me, we were on the way down there and we're like, we were having little bets. We're like, I'm always stupidly optimistic, but I was like, I bet you there's going to be 50 people there. Like, you know, like it looks, I think, you know, we were counting people we knew and stuff. And we got into Hyde Park in London. I don't know anybody in London, really, like three people. And there was like at least 300-400 people there. And it was just, they were just like, so they knew all the dogs' names and they knew, like, it's like I said, an out of body experience. I just don't understand how it's, got like this. I think I do understand. I think it's because it's like positivity in a world where there's a lot of negativity and there's a lot of you know, cost of living crisis, wars, there was COVID, there was just like every time you go online everything's negative. And also Instagram is quite fake, you know, there's a lot of everybody putting their best foot forward, whereas I just kind of just say what is on my mind. So I think that's why people like it. But it's still like, I'll have to go home next week and sit down in a dark room for 2 days and try and process it, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you did speak about that moment of wanting to find purpose or meaning, and you found it in the purest form that you're actually making such a huge difference. And as you said, people are following you, not just for you, but your dogs, the dogs, are characters in their own right, and people like to follow their stories and their journeys, and then they're with you every step of the way when, you know, there's a high moment, and unfortunately and inevitably there can be plenty of low moments as well. And when you love something so dearly, you connect with a someone, be it a person or an animal, when they're not there anymore, my God, does it hurt. And you've had a lot of that recently yourself.
Yeah, there's two dogs who've died who I have that are like super special. Snoop, who is my own dog, who I got in the DSPCA, I think it is, just outside Dublin. So I had him 12 years and he came to Manchester and Thailand with me. So he died about 10 days ago. And Tina, who was just an incredible soul, who was a golden retriever. She was on a chain and we saved her. But then, and she's had the most lovely 6 months, but then she got kidney disease and died. So two very sad stories. But also, like, I'm sitting here talking to you and I can't even explain it. There's like paintings, t-shirts that people have made me, like not mass cards, but like just like a handful of like cards that people have given me about these dogs that they've never met. So it's a really, I try and make it just as upbeat as positive. And that is real life. Like, you know, people die, dogs die, people are sick, people. And instead of glossing over it, I just try and sort of explain it how it is and put a positive spin on it. So yeah, there's a lot of sadness, but also there's a lot of joy in it as well.
You seem really pragmatic about, I suppose, the cycle of life, that everybody has a beginning and an end, and that it's part and parcel of it.
Well, that's the one thing I said to myself. If I was going to, like, I'm going to be back in a hospital bed again, you know, like I was. And hopefully it's in like, you know, 30, 40 years when I'm 80 or something, you know, like I die in my sleep. Like that's what I want. At some stage I'll be back there. And genuinely, if it happened, if I walked out and I got hit by a bus today and I died, I could actually say, like, now I'm really proud of myself and I've lived, like, I wouldn't want to be doing anything other today than, you know, like talking to you, meeting people about dogs, spreading the word. I just, for the first time in my life, I'm like proud of myself, and before I wasn't. So I'm just living the life that I love living. And that's that. I think that's, I'm very conscious that I'm blessed to be in that position.
So X amount of years ago, you were saying, you know, you might wake up at four and down a bottle of wine and as it would go throughout the day. Now, obviously, your day looks entirely different. So can you go through like a typical day in your world now when you're back home in Thailand?
Yeah, well, there's two things. So like, I love the dogs in Thailand. And if I like, my mission is to save millions of them around the world. And my ideal day would be not to do that. It would be just to go out on my moped in my flip flops, feed my own dogs that I have, potter around, play with them, do that sort of stuff. Not unfortunately, but the reality is that if I want to save millions, I need to bring people on the journey with me. I need to raise awareness. I need to do boring things like raise money and do accounting and all those sort of things that are going to be a big organization. So I do a bit more of that now. Like, this is I'm here in the UK and Ireland for a week and I'm doing like media interviews like this. I'm meeting people.
Sure.
But my heart is out on the moped feeding the dogs, and I'll never ever stop doing that. So like, I'm already excited for Wednesday morning. I'll be loading up the food, going out feeding the dogs, because that's just good for the soul. That's where my heart really is. But I the bigger mission is very important as well.
Yeah. So how many dogs do you have yourself now? I know rehoming is a big element, and I know that another vital part of what you're doing is sterilizing the dogs so that, you know, these vast numbers of stray dogs reduce, which is obviously ultimately the most important thing also.
Yeah, so there's 500 million in the world, stray dogs, believe it or not. And my aim is to halve that over the next 20 or 30 years. So I want to control the population. So 250 million. So I spend most of my time feeding them. I feed 800 at the moment. There's a little Thai woman who cooks the food for 800 dogs, and then volunteers give it out all around the island. And then I do obviously like medical stuff, so helping dogs with broken legs and stuff like that. But then we also sterilize 200 dogs a month at the moment. But that's good. That'll stop like a few thousand puppies each month coming into the world. But I really need to scale that up into like thousands of dogs being done every month. So it's like, we're just saying there, it's so short, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, I feel like I'm going really slowly, only because I see the suffering that they're in every day. Like, you know, there's dogs suffering today that I could do something about. So yeah, I'm trying to speed everything up.
Are there certain dogs now when you're away that you, I mean, it's a strange question to ask, because I know you love them all and you're going to try and help them all, but I'm sure there are certain dogs that you spend maybe perhaps a bit more time with, or you've had more of a connection with. Like, are you missing some more than others at the moment?
Big time. Like there's, you're not, I'm obviously not allowed to have favorites. Like that would be, I would be, it'd be like say having favorite kids or whatever, but I do have secret favorites, of course. The good thing is I met some of them here, which was incredible. There was like five of them that have been rehomed here. And that was just like an eye opener for me because, they're just in happy houses here and like they've come across the world and it just doesn't feel real. So, I do miss them. They're like, it's like having about 80 kids, and they've all got their little personalities and quirks and, I'll be very excited to see them again.
Yeah. You were on this morning, ITV's This Morning during the week, and I saw a reunion and it was clearly a very emotional moment for you. Did you have no idea that was happening?
No idea. Like I couldn't process it. And I was like, I was going on and like the happiest, I was like, this is all brilliant. And like, you know, just looking around, I was looking around the studio and I was just like, oh, this is, you know, so interesting and everything. And then like, like crying or anything like that wasn't even my like, and it was the happiest tears that I've ever had in my life. I was just like, this dog Hope was like, I found her in the jungle and like, she'd been shot with a nail gun. She'd been cut with a machete. I sat with her up in the jungle for like trying to rehabilitate her for months. Like she wouldn't even, I had to lift her to the toilet. She was just like a rock. She was closed down. And I think I say in the book that it kind of reminded me of my mom, like, you know, being abused. And I was kind of like, at least this time I did something. I stepped up to the plate and helped little Hope. So when I saw her, she was coming out of the studio and with Steph, her lovely owner, and she was just walking through. And I was like, holy shit, this was the dog who's in the jungle. And now she's like, here she is walking out in front of a TV audience. I was just like, this can't be real life. Like, this is just mad, you know? So I was just overcome with emotion, yeah.
And what was really gorgeous watching it as well was Hope's reaction to you, because obviously a dog is not aware of a TV studio and cameras watching, and they're not gonna, I'm gonna put it on now for the cameras.
She was so happy
to see you, and the tail is wagging, and it was beautiful. It was a real privilege to witness a very genuine moment between you both.
Yeah. And I did, they had other dogs there to surprise me after, about five of them. And I genuinely, because I haven't seen them in about 5 months, I think, four or five months, some of them. And I like, dogs do forget stuff like that. So I was kind of wondering myself, I was like, are these dogs even going to remember me? But they did. So I was like, that made me feel good. I mean, people are always like, oh, geez, the dogs remember that you saved them and stuff like that. I don't know if dogs are that smart, but they definitely remember the smells or the belly rubs or the treats I gave them. So it makes you feel lovely, yeah.
So you have these huge plans, which is admirable, and just going on your back catalogue, as it were. I have a strong feeling that it's gonna work. You're gonna succeed at what you plan on doing. But does that mean then that there'll come a day when you're gonna say goodbye to Koh Samui and leave Thailand?
I don't think so. I think I can do it from there, but I think I'm gonna have to travel more. But it's like I have a huge philosophical debate in my, like, even this book is brilliant. And I thought long and hard about it because I got like loads of offers to, you know, like promote pet insurance or, you know, anything, stuff like that, anything to make money. And I was just said no to everything. And then I was like, I'll do the book because I think it'll get the word out there and I think it can raise some money to help me. And I think, but then I'm like, even this week, I've been away for a week and I'm like, is this, in my mind, I'm like, is this helping the dogs or is it, should I be on the ground doing stuff? And like, it is helping the dogs when I step back because, you know, there's a whole new audience that will know about street dogs and help with my mission. But I think about everything just about what will help the dogs the most. And it's not always easy to make those decisions. But no, I think I can do it from Koh Samui with some travel dotted in there. But, and it's not, yeah, it's not a guaranteed success. It's a very, very hard problem to solve and very like logistically challenging, etc. But I'll give it a good shot.
And obviously a huge factor involved is the financial aspect because, you know, feeding that amount of dogs and even vet visits and sterilization, you can't do it with no funds. So obviously getting people to support what you're doing is a key part of having the buzz online and sharing what you do on likes of Instagram and all the other social media platforms. So I will add in your link into the show notes if people want to get on board and support what you do. But what are you looking at financially? How much does it cost, say, on a weekly basis to do what you do at the current level?
It started off really cheap. It was like, it's cost me about $2,000 or $3,000 a month. It's not really cheap. That's a lot of money. But it was like to feed the 800 dogs was about $3,000 a month. But what really costs a lot, yeah, is the operations. Like if a dog breaks a leg, it's kind of like, you know, European prices, it might be 500 or 1,000 euros to fix a, you know, to get an operation. And I can't, you unfortunately, you have to go around choosing then. You can't just go around fixing every dog who gets a broken leg because you wouldn't have the money. So what I do is I actually don't ask anybody for donations. Like, and I think that's good because I think, you know, when you go onto Instagram or Facebook or stuff, you see a lot of shocking images and stuff and, you know, people, charities asking for money. And it kind of not turns me off, but I'm just like, I think people are kind of don't want to see it. It's like out of sight, out of mind, you know. They don't want to see dogs with their legs broken and stuff like that. So I just try and tell positive stories. And if people figure out that they want to follow along and donate or help, it's great. But it's not, I don't force anybody. They can just watch the dog content and be happy. That's the way I think about it. And then I think to do big things like I need to build hospitals and stuff like that. Like I need to get big corporate, big money sponsors and stuff like that, which I think I'll be able to do. So it's all still moving parts in my head, but I'm doing okay. People are very helpful, and it's not just money. It's like people adopting dogs, people sending me nice things like leads and bandanas and stuff. People are unbelievable, basically.
So you're giving all the time, you're helping all the time. Your schedule at the moment is a lot of promo, obviously, for the book, and there's all this output. But are you able, are you good at taking time out for you and just saying, right, I need a bit of me time that is just me doing my own thing or taking a nap?
Terrible.
Or as you said, okay.
Terrible. Like really bad. But last night the audience is actually quite a lot of women, and it's mostly like, there's a lot of sort of like mammies who love the dogs. It's really funny. And I was doing a book signing last night, and I'd say there was about 80% of them were older women or women. And I swear to God, every single one like just pulled me aside like an Irish mommy would, and just was like, Niall, will you please just take a bit of time for yourself? You're really going very hard, you know, like, will you just have a little nap and just, we won't mind if you don't post for a day, just like, please look after yourself. So people are like really, really nice about that sort of stuff. But it's hard when there's so many nice things happening and it's exciting. And but yes, I'd be useless to everybody if I didn't take a bit of time off. So I'm going to try and do that from now on.
Yeah, because I think I saw I might have been even yesterday where you hadn't eaten all day. So I think, yeah, factoring in important things like sleep and eat and rest.
Exactly. I just forgot yesterday. Literally forgot. I was just so busy. But no, I'm not too bad. I need to get into exercise and stuff because it's mental health as well. You need to look after yourself, definitely.
So your family and your close circle of friends. It's probably an obvious answer, but how do they feel about this phase in your life where you're at now? They must be thrilled, relieved, proud. And just happy that you're in such a good place.
Yeah, I think they're just all like, yes, they definitely are. Because they're so, you know, I worried them sick, you know, like, because also I was in Thailand. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you don't have to, it's easy not to answer their phone calls or whatever, you know. So, and that would make the worry worse. But I think they're proud now. Yeah, I think they're sort of like, especially my friends, they're just in disbelief. They're like, they're keeping me nice and grounded. They're like, you know, we know you're still an annoying bollocks or whatever. I'll get messages from my friends. They're like, so they keep me nice and grounded. So I think especially my mom and dad, because like I wrote about that in the like their relationship and how it affected me. So like, you know, I don't want them to feel guilty. People just grow apart and stuff. So I'm in a very fortunate place at the moment.
And to write such an honest book, that takes a lot of courage, not just for you, but also for the people that you're writing about. Did you have that chat with them? Look, guys, I'm doing this thing. I'm going to write my story, and it's obviously going to involve you guys. So, you know, are we cool with this, or did you get their approval in advance, or how did that work?
Yeah, I sort of chatted them through it. I actually wrote it and then showed them. And like, it's all just the truth. So it's, but yeah, it's hard sometimes just writing that out. And it's hard being so honest in a book. Like, that was one of the most exhausting things ever, writing that, because it was just like, it was like going to therapy sessions. Or even the worst thing was, like, I had to read the audio version of the book, and it was in a studio in Bangkok, and there was like 4 sound engineers listening in, and I'm there reading about, you know, having a breakdown or my mom leaving me or whatever, and I'm like, and they're like, can you just read that in a slight different tone? And I'm like, yeah. And I came out of that like just
exhausted,
drained, yeah, exhausted. So but no, it's all good, it's all good.
Yeah, well, it must be a good feeling now that it's done and you're in this stage of just talking about it, that it's out there in the ether. And for those who are listening who don't already have a copy and are itching to get it, it's called Hope: How Street Dogs Taught Me the Meaning of Life. A glorious read, because you take people on the highs and lows of your life, and ultimately it's incredibly inspiring, and it gives us a lot of, you know, food for thought of what are we doing in our own lives? Like, what am I doing? What is this about, this life that I'm leading? And how you can actually completely change your circumstance and do something utterly unexpected that fills you up, but also potentially helps others. And I suppose, isn't that the real true meaning of life? We, you know, people are always talking about, you find something you're good at and you can do that, that's great, you know, and you can pay the bills and you live a nice life. But when you find something that not alone are you good at, but helps others or serves others or does good in the world, that's that step up, that's that elevated level of, right, now this really matters, what I'm doing really counts. And you're doing that.
Yeah. And I think the one thing that I'd say to people is, like, I'm 43 now. I was an alcoholic and depressed for like 25 years. And, you know, I was doing all right in life, but I was like miserable. So, like, it's never too late. You know, a lot of people look at their situation and they're like, oh, Jesus, you know, it's passed me by, or I have kids, or I'm, you know, I went to college, or what, you know, it's never too late. You know, just you can always make a change. There's hope for everybody.
Niall, thanks a million. It's been brilliant to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Great to hear a voice from home.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. And next week, I'll be resharing another conversation that resonated with fans of Ready to Be Real this year. Thanks so much for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love, and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.